Good evening and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back. Good evening. Welcome once again to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. I'm Willie Hassel, along with the lovely, the mystical, the mysterious, Lynn Nickerson.
Hello,
hey there.
Willie.
How are you?
How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Good?
Good.
And what's you? New with you?
What's new with me?
Yeah.
Nothing is new with me.
Okay.
Absolutely nothing.
That's not true.
Okay. So
Didn't you have an exciting afternoon?
Oh, I did. But I didn't want to...
So did I.
Yeah, I didn't want to give it away quite yet.
Okay. Well, we can just hint and let the audience wonder.
Yeah, we did. We had an excellent afternoon.
Yes, we did.
And so tonight on Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience, this week it is a pleasure to once again welcome to the show Jim Perry. Jim is the host and producer of the popular Euphemet podcast. It is a show about occulture, the esoteric, the enchanted, the unknown, and our relation to it, about the true stories behind the strange phenomena that are outside the sphere of popular consciousness. Jim and his crew travel the country to bring you some of the best stories of the supernatural and the people who experience them. And hey, guess what? It just happened to be our luck that they're in this part of the country. They're on the seacoast today.
They were passing through.
They just happened to be here. So we said, hey, come on in the studio. Yeah. And no, actually, the truth is that we flew them in all the way from Seattle.
Yes, with our huge budget.
with our huge radio budget, right. Absolutely. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thank you for flying me in, guys.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Are your arms tired?
A little bit.
That little turboprop plane took a while to get here, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, it was worth it, though. You know what I mean? Especially after the afternoon we had. We had a great afternoon together. Here we are sitting in this awesome community radio station that harkens back to a lot of the community stations that I was involved in Seattle. And to be in a familiar and comfortable place with friends like yourselves after experiencing a sort of an afternoon of bone chills, really.
Really?
Listen, Lynn, like, I don't know if we can just jump right into it or not, but after being a fan and reading your book and following your story and then hearing those stories in person in such a place that we were... it was revelatory in some ways, and I think what it displayed to me was the importance of the human element in these so-called haunted spaces, in these so-called active spaces, right? The human element paired with this activity that is very present, that is very real, and what our effects are with it. So to stand across from you and hear your stories, the ones that I read in your book, to hear you speak them in this place, the same place where this story is taking place,
it's cool.
Was really cool. So thank you for that.
Oh, it was our pleasure. That was so much fun. Yeah, it kind of took the wind out of my sails.
Yeah, well, before we do carry on too far, I do want to say that the name of the podcast is Euphemet, and it is a great podcast. I love the way you do it, Jim.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I do too.
It's different.
It
different
is
different than most. It's not just a talk show like this. It's different. He does the way he edits it and puts in perfect music. And now it's doing video too, and I can't wait to see that. Kyle over here is his video.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to say anything, Kyle.
Yep. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Kyle. Welcome to Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just jumping in real quick here, but No, we're introducing a video component this year, Jim and I, starting out as kind of small vignettes for the Euphemet series season two here. And it's kind of an experiment in bringing a little bit of visual life to what was before just kind of where the imagination would run away. And
right.
You want to kind of step a little further into that world and see what those people are really like and visualize them and add to that kind of imagination.
Giving depth to the stories.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Really.
So it's fun to introduce that new element to it.
Another element. I just love the premise of the storytelling because it's it goes beyond anecdotal because it's personal revelations. And I just find those stories all so interesting. I love to hear these stories of other people. I had mentioned before Fate magazine, and they have two departmental features. And one is True Mystic Experiences, and My Proof of Survival is the other one. And people write in and they talk about their own personal experiences, and there's such a variety of what they experience or how they experience the paranormal, including anything from, you know, multidimensional ghosts and UFO experiences. And that is my favorite. And this kind of translates into the audio and visual of the written word. Your show does, Euphemet. So I really, really enjoy that. I like that. You're not being preached to or not any sort of narrative or agenda is being addressed. You just let the people tell their stories. And it's fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much. And it's cool that you bring up Fate because I'm really inspired by that magazine.
Oh, do you
and
read
have
it?
Been for a long time. Yeah, I'm like that typical sort of paranormal geek that has a stack of them
geek.
In every corner of his apartment, you know?
I save them all.
Yeah. So, you know, looking back at those firsthand stories, those were the kind of stories that really intrigued me and inspired me.
Oh, truly?
Yeah, because at that point, you can see beyond the phenomenon itself, and you see it more as a relationship to the human condition in some fashion. And that's not to say it's a relationship to the human condition to discount what the phenomenon is, but to me personally, the human interaction with whatever that phenomenon may be is the most important thing.
You get it at the personal level. It's not just a story about some unknown person. It's the people telling the stories themselves.
Yeah.
And it's very engaging.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, for me, I love the transformation element. I love finding stories where someone's life is affected or changed, or their perspective, their paradigm has shifted.
Mm.
Because in those stories, I think folks, normal folks, regular folks out there who have either experienced things themselves or may have not can find connection.
Commonality.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Commonality.
Yep.
I agree with you.
Yep.
So you kind of tout yourself as an explorer of a culture, right? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what that may mean, you know, that a culture is not, I don't even think is a real term per se.
We're
I know
talking
some
occult,
yeah,
not a culture, but occulture.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Great, great, great. We're clarifying that. You know, to me, occult really has been, despite its popular misconceptions, the occult is a little bit of a catch-all for a lot of phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what better way to view some of that phenomenon through the lens of our culture? How does things like acculturization, how does the influences and our everyday life, how we move through this reality as 3D human beings, right, as like meat bodies, how do we move through this stuff? And then how is it affected or transported to this paranormal realm? So that's really what's exciting to me.
And how do you integrate what we don't understand, this supernatural, this paranormal? How do we integrate that into our 3D lives? And I think your show is a good vehicle for that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah,
I really
thank you
do.
So much.
So I was listening to a few of your broadcasts, and I listened to one in particular called Into the Fray. And she was talking to you. Or rather, you were talking to him, to her, rather, about Balthazar and how that was kind of a pivotal point in you taking a break from Euphemet and maybe taking a different approach in the future. But you had to kind of reconnoiter and figure out for yourself exactly what reality was all about. So would you like to elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think with Euphemet, there have been several points in time where I've realized that I don't know what I believe anymore. You know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a lot of folks will describe that as like sort of a shattering or a download, or there's a lot of different ways I think people try to describe it. But, you know, some of it is beyond words, I think, because, you know, I think perhaps the mystics would say, well, that is the ego perhaps interacting with qualities of reality, perhaps. To me, what it feels like is I don't know what's going on anymore.
Your beliefs get shattered because it doesn't fit into your belief system. Yeah. A lot of it doesn't.
Yeah, they really don't. And what I experienced during the first season of Euphemet, when I was on the road, when I was, you know, in Sedona with Peter Gersten, and I was in the forests of British Columbia with a man that, you know, believed he was communicating and communing with a Sasquatch family through glyphs. When I was with this very real vampire, now we can talk about what classifies as a vampire and what doesn't. When I was having these experiences and more, the quality of these experiences, the phenomenon itself, tended to look back at me and my open heart into these experiences and start to confirm things and start to reveal itself in very interesting ways and frightening ways for me in some ways, because what was interesting to me, and I can describe my very last episode that I produced was this episode entitled Obscura, and it was the fourth episode of this mini series, and this mini series essentially went back and looked at the stories of season one, and it acted as like a sort of a travelogue. And what that travelogue was doing was helping me kind of look back through tape, give me excuse to look back through tape, and see if I could glean about what I was really supposed to learn from some of this stuff. The last episode I released was a confessional, essentially.
Oh.
And this confessional was that I had seen something during a taping, during a particular taping in West Virginia, deep in the hallways of West Virginia, in this haunted hotel, essentially. I was with a friend, Greg Newkirk, a very talented paranormal investigator and a part of Hellier, which is a documentary series I'd like to talk about later. And we were there with a man who seemingly was discovering some sort of mediumship abilities that night, that very night, reckoning with this lifelong ability to connect with perhaps something else. We were seeing it manifest right before our eyes. And so it became this very, very interesting dichotomy of Greg going, you know what, like, I think you're a psychic, you know, and him like helping him kind of like Greg working with some of the best psychics in the world, helping him kind of like feel out his abilities a little bit in this very dark, very big, very cold, cavernous old hotel.
Are you going to tell the audience what you're referring to specifically, as in the statue, Billy?
Oh, no, so that's completely, that's
was that different?
It was a different thing. Yeah,
okay.
So Greg Newkirk, like, that was an experience I had with him as well.
Because it sounded
kind of
like
shook
the same
me to
thing.
It shook me to the core. That kind of stuff follows him, seemingly, and I think it follows some other people as well, if I'm being honest, and I pointed to Lynn. What happened that night is I saw a ghost. I saw an entity.
Oh, you did?
With my own two eyes.
Okay, so how did it appear to you?
So what had happened is, as we were roaming these halls, the guy's name was Wes, and he was telling us what he was experiencing. He was telling us that down the hallway, this he could see this man, and this man was walking up and down the halls, and he was angry, and he was, when are you going to clean this place? It's so messy. What is happening here? And, you know, very authoritarian, you know, over 6 feet tall, large stature. And he was very angry. Wes was also seeing other things.
Now, this was Wes that was seeing us and not you.
This was Wes.
Okay.
Yeah, and he took us down this long, dark hallway on the side of a stairwell. And he was describing in detail this entity. And this this character was moving back and forth between this room and the hallway. The room and the hallway. And then a woman appears. And this woman is angry. And she's sort of almost glitching in between this room and the hallway. And the woman and the man are having some sort of interaction. So it got, you know, it got very deep very quickly. And here's Wes, Greg, and I standing at the end of a very dark, very cold hallway, no lights, and hearing this person essentially pick up on these spirits and these interactions and these very visceral, like almost angry spirits. And at that point, it was a little much. And I just said, you know what, like maybe let's, we should probably reset a little bit, you know what I mean? And everybody was okay with that. And we took a step outside of the hallway.
Now, this Wes, he was pretty agitated because of the...
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was in the process of discovery, right?
Okay.
And he didn't know exactly what he was doing. And also, when you're not comfortable sharing that type of information, those type of experiences with anyone that lives around you, and here's your opportunity now, and you are now in a safe space where people who have experienced various levels of paranormal activity are listening to you and taking you seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that was a part of his nerves too, you know, because he was able to finally really truly interpret these things that were coming across through his vision to someone else who was listening, right? So that was truly an emotional moment. So we reset and we stepped outside of the hallway, and Greg is asking him some more questions, and I have my mic in his face like I had in years earlier tonight. And I'm looking beyond Wes's shoulder into the deep, dark hallway that we just came from. And almost floating is a translucent, sort of smoky, hazy sort of energy orb.
Did it have a shape?
It didn't at first. It didn't at first. The first, it was a little bit amorphous. But slowly, it started to form into the bust of a man. And at that time, within that formed details, formed contrast that seemed human-like from the head to the shoulders to the chest. And this form, as it moved, as it glided from that hallway into the doorway, the same doorway and hallway that Wes was seeing all this transpire in, the form took more and more shape, and it looked like the bust of a 6-foot-tall man. And I saw that, and I immediately discounted it, and I immediately met it with all the shame in the world.
Shame?
Yeah. I was ashamed of seeing that thing. Because at that point...
This happens to other people, not me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at that point, it's like, well, it's cool. I can go and I can do these stories. I can have a curious interest. And I can have an open heart. And I can look at this very empathetically. And maybe I feel things. And maybe I get tingly. And maybe my fascia ignites. And, you know, the mystics can tell me that that's some sort of psychic reaction or some sort of spiritual reaction. And that's great. But seeing it, seeing something like that with my own two eyes made me feel so ashamed that I didn't tell anybody for a long time. So I, you know, after that, Greg and I, we jump back in the minivan, and it's all, you know, we're joking and we're kind of slap happy. And then we go and we stay in a hotel somewhere downstate. And I'm with him for another 16 hours or so after that. And it wasn't until this last episode of Obscura where I gave him a call and I said, Greg, I have a confession for you. And he said, oh, no. What does that mean? And I said, you know, man, did I tell you what I saw? And he's like, oh, I think you might have told me it was like a light or something. Or like, I was like, dude, it was more. And I couldn't tell you because I was ashamed of it.
I don't understand the shame, though.
Yeah, I don't quite get
a
that.
A hesitation, yes. But yeah.
It took you to another level, obviously.
Yeah, and but. I think that's where it came from. I think that for the first time, I was truly able to put myself in the place of the people that I feature. And really, truly, I'm talking about like empathetically connecting and opening my heart to what their experiences are. And that's great. But I think there was something, there was still that buffer in between where, okay, at that point, I really didn't know what I believed. But I think it was a way for me to truly empathize with the people I feature. Because at that point, I knew how they felt when they were, you know, anxiously telling me their stories, but maybe not telling me everything.
So you probably felt a little bad that you didn't always believe these people that told you their stories, right?
Was
that underlying it?
That's the crazy thing is I did believe them.
You did, okay.
Yeah, I did believe them because I believe that even, you know, I believe in people's story being their story. And it's not for me to almost believe or not to believe. And that's always been my role as even a storyteller. It's really more about what their experience is. And their experience is their experience. Their story is their story. All I can do is try to honor that as best I can. For me, it was a personal thing. It was an insecurity. It was an insecurity because I, for so long, was able to sit on the other side of the fence and go, okay, well, I'm going to tell these stories, but like, it's not about me. It's about the feature. It's about the guest. This time, I was pulled into it and it became about me very quickly. And that was uncomfortable because you've met like, okay, I'm making it everything else, but it's really about the folks. That time it became about me. And I now have to be like my guest and go out into the world and say, I see ghosts and take on anything else that can bring with it. Right. You know, we were having a really great conversation earlier today about how this community, experiencers that are open about what has transpired, what they have experienced, is a marginalized group.
Yeah.
And it can feel like a very lonely planet.
That's
for you.
That's right.
The internet helps, right? But you still have people like Wes in West Virginia that can't share that with anyone in his family, can't share that with any of his friends, can't connect with a real person sitting next to him and tell him, like, hey, this was, I don't know what this was, but so I felt like I was in that space until I realized that I am lucky. I have a lot of friends and a lot of compatriots that I can tell this stuff and they go, so what? I've experienced like way crazier things than that. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's great to have a friend like Carl, who by all means has probably experienced way more crazy things than me. So
I do want to ask, have you seen anything, Carl?
I'm not too much of a seeing guy. I think that there's almost a certain psychic level required to see stuff.
Yeah, it's just a different part of your brain or whatever.
I worked at the Stanley Hotel for 5 years with various public paranormal investigations there on the weekends. And it was always fascinating, like the people that might leave on a given hot weekend. And like some of them saw something and other people didn't. And I always thought that was kind of interesting. So the times that I've actually seen anything have been kind of few and far between. There's only been kind of like 3 or 4 maybe in years of doing this, in a decade of doing this, and they're usually kind of a fleeting kind of faint, it sounds like actually a less tangible way than Jim's story, but obviously interesting in its own context.
Then do you feel that you're somewhat empathic? Do you sense changes? I mean, do you sense energy or anger, emotions, that sort of thing?
You know, when I worked at the Stanley, I used to joke that I was about as sensitive as a rock, right? Or psychic as a rock, anyways, right?
Yeah, I know somebody else like that.
Yeah, very similar earlier, yeah. But one of the interesting things, it's been suggested to me a lot, and I've always kind of had a sense that there is something going on within me, but I've got a lot of blocks and stuff up in the way.
Yeah, blocking it, yep.
And I'm very aware of some of those blocks and whatever future journey I might have going down that path. But what was interesting about working at the Stanley was it was a place that I could return to again and again and again, a lot like you guys have with the house that we were at. And what's cool about that is you start to get a sense of that space. And we could walk into that space 3 times a weekend for months, and it would feel one way. But then you know, 4 months in, you walk in and you're like, it feels different tonight.
Well, that's good. You do notice the differences.
Exactly, yeah. So it was kind of like a progression where, you know.
It is a progression.
Yeah, where you do like a weekend ghost hunt wherever, you know, like one a month, whatever a team might have access to or whatnot. But there's something about coming back to a place that has activity, is very active like the Stanley, and kind of ebbs and flows that you
it
can
does.
Start to get in touch with it. And that was a really
fascinating
experience. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So building on that has been kind of interesting for me.
Well, I think you're opening your awareness. And like you say, it is a progression. Mm-hmm. And I did want to say for the benefit of the audience that what Carl is talking about is the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park in Colorado, a famous subject of Stephen King.
Oh, that's
the
right.
The Shining.
Yeah. Yeah, The Shining.
Inspired The Shining in the 70s.
Yes, and yeah. Carl has been there several times, and I imagine you have too, right,
yep.
Jim? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, Carl and Connor took me through the Estes Method, which is a technique for divination that's a little bit of a play on a spirit box modification greatly sort of hypercharges or at least focuses, I think, your ability to interpret what's going on there. And they took me through this process of seeing them do this, and I was shocked and amazed about some of the activity that happened. These guys, because of their experience with it, I'm very pedestrian in terms of anything, in terms of ghost investigations. I'm not a ghost investigator, so I'm very like, oh my gosh, like, what was that? You know, they just to describe it a little bit, to set the tone, and Carl, of course, could like describe it much better, but I'm going to give it a shot as a pedestrian. You know, there's a spirit box, right? And this essentially works like a broken radio tuner, kind of like scan set to it, and it clips along, and it gives you different little fragments of what can appear on the radio. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you get full words, sometimes you get full sentences, sometimes you get little bits and bops, and you know. Most frequently, folks will, you know, turn the thing on and sit in the middle of the room, and they'll go, okay, now let's talk to it. And they'll kind of talk to it or talk at it and then listen. And then it's kind of like a groupthink interpretation, and that can kind of... So these guys are like, you know what? Let's do this a little differently. Again, I'm just telling your story for you. It's great.
It's your show, dude. I'm just sitting up here.
They slapped a pair of headphones, noise-canceling headphones, a blindfold.
Yeah.
And one person receives the information. They sit there. They receive it. They say whatever is being interpreted. And the other one will ask questions and try to engage.
And can they hear each other?
They can't hear each other.
Well, the question can hear.
Okay.
Who's asking? The one asking the questions can hear what is happening, but the one engaging with the spirit box directly is just hearing the spirit box and just saying what happened. So I was witness to this. And his partner in crime with this, Connor Randall, was receiving, and Carl was asking questions. And, you know, to me, it was fantastic because Jim was coming through. Jim, are you recording? Things like this were coming through in full sentences. And when I would hear that, I would get a little, like, faint and a little giddy about it. And really, it was like I could see how folks can really attach themselves to a divination technique like this and get very, very excited about it very quick.
It's almost addictive.
Yeah, I can see that. So it was fascinating to experience that at a place like the Stanley Hotel. Because you talk about a historically notorious haunted location. It is everything that one would expect. Both visually, it activates your senses in a way that is unparalleled to a lot of places. You know, doesn't disappoint.
Okay, Jim and Carl, we're at the bottom of the hour, so what we're going to do is just take a quick break. We're speaking with Jim Perry and Carl
Pfeiffer.
Thank you. Of Euphemet, and we'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Yeah, Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. listening to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience on WSCA 106.1 FM in Portsmouth's West End. And tonight we have in the studio with us from the Euphemet podcast, Jim Perry, and his wonderful videographer, Carl
Pfeiffer.
Carl Pfeiffer. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, you're telling us about your ghost box episode, and it was kind of challenging your beliefs, let's say?
I don't know if that one was challenging my beliefs as much as exciting every cell of my body, right?
Wow.
You know, that's what's interesting about taping the show in this fashion, as boots on the ground is required. A lot of intimate time with the featured guests is required. Mm-hmm. And to see the spaces and to experience just perhaps a taste of what they've experienced, right?
Well, was it random words or were you getting answers to questions?
A little of both. But okay. I think I would defer to Carl. You know, the interesting thing is after we did this experiment, which, mind you, was on the fourth floor of the Stanley, which allegedly is one of, like, sort of the most active, you know, I was very impressed. Carl and Connor were like, that was all right. You know what I mean? Because when you have that many years of experience doing this sort of boots-on-the-ground research in one location, you have good days and bad nights, right? And you've heard it all before. And, you know, I think was impressed with it my first time I experienced it, right? And I think once you start getting to a realm where you're like, oh, it said my name. You know, you start thinking about it a different way that's maybe a little more ego-driven, and it's not hard to sort of selfishly build up expectations that way if I'm just being completely honest.
You know?
Had to refrain a little bit from it and be like, yeah, it's okay, you guys are right. It sucked. But really inside I was like, it asked me if I was recording. What does that mean? You know, but Carl, like, it was not too dissimilar to a lot of, you know, kind of like average times that you've done it, right?
Yeah. I mean, anyone who's ghost hunted before kind of gets used to the fact that, like, it's 98% pretty quiet nights without too much happening.
Uh-huh.
And the Estes Method experiment, I mean, you do hear bits and sounds, you know, and it's one thing when a group all knows the question and they're asking it of a speaker and they can all hear the response and maybe twist it. There is still, I think, a certain degree of awareness from the listener, even though they can't hear the questions, you know, like Connor knew Jim was in the room. So my brain kind of goes to, like, maybe that impression was kind of in his mind a little bit, that sort of thing. So it comes to that repeatability element where our standard, our bar gets kind of raised, where we're like, we need like 2 minutes of back and forth, you know, or like we need some specific answers. And that's just kind of the challenge of doing something long enough is just kind of raising that expectation bar or even necessity bar, I think, just for a certain degree of like convincing us when we've kind of seen all the kind of possible false positives.
But were there any significant responses for you personally?
Over the years that we've been doing it, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting experiment with kind of the way that the paranormal goes for me in general. I kind of ebb and flow with it. You know, if you have a quiet couple of months, you start to go, I don't know, you know, was I just making a lot out of nothing?
Yeah, I know you do question.
Yeah,
that.
And then you have like a hot month and you're like, man, this is a crazy field, isn't it? So the method is very similar to that. So we've had some very, very crazy nights with it that have been very impressive.
Well, I like that approach with the blindfold and the headphones because, I mean, just your normal spirit box session, especially people asking yes or no questions or something like that, it's so easy to just, oh, that sounded like yes. Or even a name or something, you're expecting it and you make it sound like it, but
kind of waters down the validity.
Yeah, if you don't know what the question is, I can see that's
more significant.
I haven't tried that yet. I've heard of this technique. I haven't tried it, but I would like to. I'd like to. I'm skeptical myself about the spirit box in the first place, though, where it is radio, you know?
Absolutely. You know, if one of us said demon really loud right now, maybe somebody with a spirit box just hit the station and just got real scared, you know?
Yes. But there are some real relevant words that come up that, you know, just don't appear to be so random. They do seem applicable and sort of germane to the situation.
Oh, did we tell you the station is haunted, too?
Nope. Excellent.
Yeah, there was some
fitting.
And I also want to mention, if anybody wants to ask Jim or Carl a question, 603-430-9722, or you can just text a question to the same number, 603-430-9722.
Now, I want to move along to another topic really quickly. Given that I have had a haunted object, I was very intrigued about Jim's story about Billy the statue. And again, wasn't this something that kind of made you question your belief system about reality?
It did, and the timing was interesting, because when I had taped this episode, it was maybe 3 or 4 episodes into the first season. And this was me committing to this exercise of being out on the ground, embedded with these folks. And really, I had the responsibility, being on the network at that point, to really deliver. I couldn't just say, I couldn't say, too weird, I'm out. It wasn't going to work that way. I had to create, and I had to push forward through some weird stuff. And this was one of those occasions where it set the tone for the rest of the season. What had happened is Greg and Dana Newkirk, they run the museum of the paranormal and the occult, and they travel around with alleged haunted objects. And within that, their ability to sort of humanize things that otherwise could be sort of scary or nefarious is, they're great at that, right? And I think that's part of a part of why they love doing what they're doing is, you know, not these things that we can't understand, we shouldn't necessarily always be scared of. And so within this project, you know, they'll get things donated to them. They'll go and find different artifacts. And over time, they develop relationships.
Personalized relationships. Yeah. Yeah, that is so unusual. Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people will say that there's, you know, I think a lot of mystics would say that spirits in everything, right? Spirits in a rock, spirits in a tree, spirits in a chair. Spirits in statues.
Well, they could just ignore that and just put them away in storage and ignore them, but they go to make an effort to contact them, communicate with them, and personalize the relationship, which is so unusual.
And not only that, Lynn, some of these things are dying to be heard. And that's where it gets really interesting, because your dreams are not safe. Your normal waking life isn't safe. Your walk to the bathroom to get a drink of water to brush your teeth.
You could be intercepted at any point by something you cannot see.
Absolutely. And Greg and Dana, they are maniacs because they live with all of this stuff.
Sure, I don't know
every day.
How you do that,
you know, not to mention them being like sort of a paranormal tag team that live together and are a couple. So at that point, they are completely engrossed and committed to all of this work 100% of the time. But, you know, they have certain objects that are very active. Mm-hmm. They have an object called Billy. He's Billy the idol.
For the statue.
For obvious reasons.
Is it like an African idol?
It
is. Like a wood carving?
Yeah, it's a wood carved from a Nikisi tribe, an African tribe, loaded with all sorts of supernatural lore, powers, abilities. They're essentially sort of Sherpas for the witch doctors or spiritualists.
So it was like a ritual artifact then,
yeah,
right?
Right. And so, you know, a lot of this phenomenon will happen in dreams in terms of communications. Greg started to have dreams. Ooh. Greg started to have communications, and it wanted something, wanted to tell them something. People can listen to this full episode in the first season. I believe it's episode 9, maybe, that this occurs in.
Hi, actually, yeah, it was...
Please correct me if I'm wrong.
It was February 2019 of the intro to the... Into the Fray radio. That's where I got that story
from.
So you might have repeated it a couple of times.
Yeah, episode 8,
okay.
Idol of Nightmares, is where this full story is. Yeah, and they developed a very fascinating relationship, which led me to want to ask Billy questions, because he was communicating. So I did.
You didn't see a walk across the floor, did you?
No.
Okay, good.
So Billy sits upon an altar of all sorts of goods. People give Billy a lot of different little ceremonial objects, from smokes to money to candy to bottles of booze. They give him offerings. And that's very symbolic of what they would do within his actual tribe, right? So he sits on a shrine right below an obsidian mirror. So take that for what it is. He doesn't like it either, by the way. So he sits there, and he will communicate with you through EVP. And that's what I experienced firsthand.
Didn't you say at the beginning they felt that the statue was very angry?
Everyone thought the statue was very angry.
And that it wanted to communicate.
Yeah, because it was screaming. It was yelling at people, and that's how it was coming through.
And was it something they heard? Was it in their head, or was it recorded?
It was recorded.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, if you go onto their website, I can't remember what it is right now. But you will be able to find on their YouTube recorded EVP of Billy screaming.
Was that Paramuseum? The Paramuseum?
Yeah, paramuseum.com.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I bet that's a trip. I would like to check that out.
Yeah.
The idea is just very disconcerting, isn't it? So you started communicating with Billy.
Yes. At the very end of our conversation, we're sitting cross-legged in their living room, hanging out with their cats. And, you know, Greg just got done telling me this very emotional story about his connection to Billy, which, again, I don't want to get into because I won't do it justice.
Okay.
And it's on that episode 8.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're kind of sitting there, and we're all kind of in tears at this point. Because it's a very deep emotional story. And I go, you know what? I wouldn't feel right if I didn't ask this. I wouldn't feel right if I didn't ask Billy if I could talk to him and get his perspective on this. Can I do that? Is that okay? And Greg's like, sure, you can try. And so, okay, well, I get up there and I have my mic and everything else, and Greg pulls out an EVP recorder, and he says a little word to Billy and puts the EVP, stands there, holds the EVP recorder, and I begin to ask Billy questions. And, you know, they're kind of like, I'm nervous about it because here I am. I'm about to interview a statue. what is the meaning of reality if he answers me back at this point? I've really set myself up here. So,
weren't you concerned about it being a negative energy?
I wasn't.
Entity?
No, okay. Not at this point. Because at this point, it's established that he's not angry anymore.
Okay.
And he's found like sort of a solace, and he's found a relationship with Greg and Dana who he cares for very much. There's a love between them. I mean, they go on trips and Billy rides, you know, on the center console next to them when they go on trips. So it's a deep, really connected relationship. So I wasn't scared of anything negative or I wasn't scared that he was going to scream at me or anything else. But you know, I wasn't sure if there was going to be communication or not, and I was going in with no expectations, but just the circumstance of it all. If he contacts me back, if he answers any of these things, what is that going to make me feel about reality at that point? The first time through, no answers. Greg goes, well, let me try something. I take a step back, and Greg leans over to Billy and whisper some stuff to him, and he goes, okay, I'm just gonna set this down now. So he sets the EVP recorder down at Billy's feet, and he walks away. So he's standing behind us, and he goes, go ahead, try it now. So I start in through the questions, and I have these all included in this episode. All of Billy's answers are recorded because he answered every single question that I asked him. And to me, I can understand what he's saying. Now, is that some form of pareidolia? Am I connecting dots? Maybe. Sure. But, you know, this EVP recorder will only pick up when there is, like, sort of an audible signature, right? Mm-hmm. It picked up something, and it picked up a voice. And to me, he gave me solid, succinct answers to all the questions I had. I asked him things like, what cat is your favorite? What do you think about the black mirror behind you? What do you think about Greg and Dana? And he gave me answers to these things. And it was at that point, again, it was a paradigm shift. It was a shattering of sorts where it was like, what do I do with that? A statue just communicated back to me. Or at least this idea that perhaps this statue answered these questions. You know, so how do you not believe in some of this stuff after that, you know?
Yeah. You have to wonder, is the statue haunted? Does it really have a consciousness, not necessarily being the statue consciousness, but maybe the consciousness of another entity? But remember when we spoke to, his name isn't on the tip of my tongue, the Native American shaman, his first name I think is Michael. He talked to us about the masks, that some of the Native Americans have ritual masks, and the masks are regarded as being living. They have personalities.
I remember the subject, but I don't
It'll
remember the
It'll come to me,
because
I'm pulling this out of my memory banks here. But he said to the guy who is the guardian of the masks, he had a friend over, and the friend was staring at the mask. He said, don't stare at them. It makes them uncomfortable. And so what are you talking about? He says, they've got personalities. They're real people. Their hair even grows, and they eat. How do you understand that? He didn't take it from the perspective that they were inhabited, that they are living, live something. That kind of sounds like Billy.
Yeah, perhaps.
It's hard to logically explain something that is totally illogical because science doesn't have any words to express it.
Yeah.
So it does blow your mind when you're trying to. It does break your belief system.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a much weirder world than what I think we give it credit for, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where'd you go from there? In what you thought was real.
I had to just keep going. That was one of those situations where, again, you know, the funny thing about this project is before with Euphemet, I could experience something like sort of mind-blowing. And before it was a documentary show, and I could say, I'm just going to take a break from this a little bit. I'm going to reset. I didn't have that opportunity during the first season of Euphemet. I had to persist. I had to continue, and I had to deal and work through these feelings I had. And it's reflected all the way up through the last episode of season one, where I found myself in the middle of the Mojave with a bunch of mystics and yogis and oracles having a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And me being a bystander to that, trying to do a show, but finding myself asking more questions about my situation than sometimes the questions of the people that I was featuring. Because I think that I felt alone at that point in time, mm-hmm. after all those incidents, but quickly realized that, you know, although I felt sort of stranded in this desert with no one around, that I was out there with a bunch of other people that experienced some stuff too, right? So maybe we're not all out in the desert alone. Maybe we're in the desert together. And that's what I took away from that entire season. Yeah.
Well, then you continued on with Euphemet. So how did season two differ from season one?
Well, firstly, season two is completely independent. I've reclaimed the show from the network that I was working with. We did some great work together, but it just ran its course, and I was excited to bring it back on and continue exploring and experimenting with the format a little bit and doing it like sort of a little bit at my own pace. So one of the differences people can expect from season two is it's a little shorter. You know, season one was 18 episodes. That was pretty intense.
I would think so.
You know,
it's quite a few.
I was not home very often at all last year, so I'd like to be home a little bit more. And so to do that, I'm breaking the seasons up a little bit. So season two will be, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 episodes, and so forth. So
what I was getting at, though, there was a change that took place in you, and didn't you realize that you can present these stories, but you don't necessarily have to understand them and be of them? Wasn't that kind of the change that took place in your approach to the new euphemism?
Yeah.
You think?
I don't know. Like, right now, like, I feel I'm very... We've taped 4 episodes so far of the season 2. We're in the middle of it right now. We're taping 4 more or something in the next 4 days. I don't know. Something crazy. We've been on the road over a week, working very nonstop fashion. And I still don't know. I still think that it's going to take me a while to find what my position is again. Mm. I'm a little bit like a ship out to sea right now, both sort of like spiritually and emotionally with all this stuff. But I'm relying on the work. I'm relying on the process to help me get through it. Being like sort of still really confused, understanding what my place in it as a participant, as like sort of a co-creator in this. So I'm really relying on the stories and the people I'm communicating with. And if I can tell their stories and do them justice, mm-hmm. I think I'll learn more about myself that way than really kind of, you know, focusing on, liminality, right? Focusing on this space of in between, focusing on this very nebulous version of reality that I find myself in right now.
I think everybody has to have their own reality construct. When they have new information, then their construct just kind of metamorphoses a little bit and it expands. So it includes more stuff. Not that you can necessarily define it, but it starts to make sense to you. It just takes on a different patina. It becomes multifaceted. So I think it just grows.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I hope that's what I started experiencing.
You're broadening your horizons. Well, we haven't got too much more time left, but I did... Well,
yeah, we got about 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay,
please.
Good. I did want to ask you also about your experience in British Columbia with Sasquatch and the code language that you talked about, in the language of light.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was a very interesting trip. We didn't exactly know what we were going to get out of this trip, but I knew that there was a man named Brian who, deep in the forests of British Columbia, felt like he was communicating with the Sasquatch family through various means of signs and symbols. What those signs and symbols turned out to be were the forms of glyphs. And these glyphs would be left on the forest floor for those who understood what this language would pick up on and interpret and feel some sort of connection to. And these glyphs, okay, they would be sticks laid in certain formations. They'd be rocks stacked in certain ways. And within these glyphs, there would be consistency in messaging. The humans that were interacting with these glyphs would see these consistencies and begin to build a language system for them. Mm. They would be representative of what these Sasquatch people, these Sasquatch families, were trying to depict. So according to them, certain symbols were signified of certain Sasquatches, were like their name.
Yep.
Certain glyphs were associated with the feeling of love, or you know, you'll see often in the very sort of terrestrial world of Sasquatch hunters and even Sasquatch scholars at this point. You know, the idea of the X being stay out, stay away, etc. Well, perhaps that means something different. Perhaps that means something more. And so Brian, you know, one day he's walking his dog in this rural British Columbia town. The next he has this yearning to go and explore the deep forests of British Columbia through the thick vegetation, through the towering mountain heights. He has found solace in finding these symbols and finding repeat symbols and then having visualizations and then seeing the Sasquatch as he developed a relationship with him and leaving glyphs of his own to say hello,
really?
This is me, etc. They begin to appear to him in very real ways.
Wow.
And then he began to engage with him in other sort of poignant ways, like throwing rocks back and forth with something that could be described as a juvenile Sasquatch, perhaps.
Yeah.
But them also representing themselves as like sort of tricksters a little bit.
Yeah.
As sort of
I've heard that.
In this dimension and not maybe. Sort of a little bit abstract in how they presented themselves and interestingly enough, would appear as mundane things to some. And perhaps in their true form to others. There was a time Brian describes him walking down a path and his friend, rather, he would call out, man, look at that. That's a, did you see that Squatch? Like, did you see, he's like, that dog? You know, and vice versa.
Yeah.
They would have different interpretations of these things appearing as different animals.
Well, supposedly ETs do the same thing. It makes you think that they're essentially shapeshifters. They're going from one dimension to another. Or they could also affect how you interpret what you're seeing.
True. Owls, screen memories, Mike Clellan.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's a lot of that.
And on that note, we are about out of time. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, I know. Come on.
Just a couple more minutes.
And, I'm sorry. We don't have a couple more minutes. Websites, stuff like that.
Yeah, euphemet.com. You can find the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at It's Jim Perry and the show at Euphemet all across social. And what about you, Carlo? You got like a cool thing going on right now, right?
I've got a project called Hellier, H-E-L-L-I-E-R. It's a documentary season one. Gets into goblins and some weird stuff. So I'll leave that there for now. But Euphemet season two.
Yeah, June 8th.
All right, cool. Very
great.
Cool. Jim, Carl, thank you both very much.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate you flying all this way just to see us.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, guys. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
And that's Spirit Radio. And hey, next week, a very special show. We have the host of History Channel's Drilling Down, The Curse of Oak Island.
Oh, that's right.
Maddie Blake is going to be joining us.
Yeah. That'll be
people know about the treasure and the curse, but
Oak Island.
But most people don't know there's a lot of paranormal activity too,
ooh,
which Maddie is going to be filling us in on.
Oh, excellent! Because I hadn't heard that angle. Mm-hmm. All right, everyone, thank you for listening. You have a good evening.